Next, we turn to Africa. AFRICOM, the U.S. Africa Command, was established by the Defense Department in 2008. The military stated that U.S. policy toward Africa for the foreseeable future would be defined by international terrorism, the increasing importance of African oil to American energy needs, and the expanding role of China in African development. The White House and the State Department couched the mission in humanitarian terms as part of efforts to bring peace and security to the people of Africa and promote our common goals of development, health, education, democracy, and economic growth in Africa. What's been the impact of this new centralized military presence on African people? How has it increased militarism on the continent, and how are grassroots feminists resisting this new threat to their security and sovereignty? Next up is an in-depth discussion by Women's Magazine's Priti Mangala Shekhar with Nigerian feminist activist and scholar Amina Mama. Amina Mama is the author of Beyond the Masks, Race, Gender, and Subjectivity.
This is Priti Mangala Shekhar for KPFA Women's Magazine. I have with me Amina Mama. Amina is currently the director of the Women and Gender Studies program at the University of California at Davis. She spent the past decade as the first chair in gender studies at the University of Cape Town in South Africa, where she was also the director of the African Gender Institute. Amina is a widely published activist and scholar and the founding editor of the Continental Journal of Gender Studies, Feminist Africa. And she's here with us today to talk about issues around militarism. Welcome to our program, Amina.
Thank you for inviting me on, Priti.
Can you begin by defining or breaking down militarism as a concept and a term?
Yes, I mean, the word is rooted in military, militaristic, militarization. So, you know, if you were to trace the origins of the word, it would be linked to armies, weaponry, and war making. But as a broader concept, and as we use it nowadays, particularly within the women's movements, it's much bigger and more pervasive than just a concern with armies and armaments and weaponry and war. It's a concept that tries to capture what it means when a whole society is affected by a growing invasion, if you like, of the cultural, ideological, political, and economic spaces by a commitment to militarization. So it goes way beyond militarization. It permeates people's identities. The meaning of what it is to be a man becomes militarized. The meaning of what it is to be a woman becomes distorted by the pervasiveness of a whole society being affected by a preoccupation with Catherine Lutz refers to as a state of war preparedness. So it means that it's not only the military forces that are mobilized, but the economy of the country becomes distorted in the service of that security agenda. The culture, the schools, the media, everything becomes affected by it. So as a concept, militarism refers to that much broader, more invidious presence of the effects of a strongly militarist element in the political and security arenas.
Why is this a feminist issue?
Well, it's a feminist issue because when you think about or speak, you know, think about militarism as a concept, as a phenomenon, the first thing that you conclude is that it's an enormous challenge to women's rights. So that's the short answer. The ways in which militarism affects women's rights is very global. It's very wide and far-reaching. The most obvious refers to the fact that today's wars largely affect civilians. So more women than ever before are victims of conflicts and violence. 90% of the casualties of contemporary wars are civilians, and within that, women and children are very, very pervasively affected. Wars are no longer fought between men. If you think about the current scenario in Iraq, these are wars fought on streets, in communities. So that's one reason, just the sheer rise in the percentage of women casualties. And that's perhaps the crudest indicator. Another reason why it might be a feminist issue is because today there are more women than ever before involved in the fighting. Even though the United States officially women are not supposed to be in combat. They've needed to take women into Iraq to do the house-to-house searches that accompany the kind of warfare that has been sustained there. So you have the highest number proportion of women soldiers in the US military than ever before. Similarly, in the periphery, if you look at the African conflicts, as many as 30% of the soldiers, the fighters in those various militias in Liberia and Sierra Leone were women and young girls. So as victims, as fighters, it just involves far more women than ever before. And that growth has to concern us because of its destructive effects on entire communities. When women become militarized in such extreme ways, it's devastating. More broadly, moving from direct military involvement and impact to the broader term militarism, then you want to look at the way in which a militarized nation has a militarized economy, which means that the economy is skewed to high spending on armaments, which is inversely proportional to the spending on schools, welfare, all the public facilities that have been gained over decades of women's struggles, the first to be compromised when a nation or a region becomes militarized. So there's those indirect effects. And beyond direct effects and beyond the economy, then you can talk about the social consequences of that distortion. You can talk about the meaning of politics and how that becomes distorted when models of leadership are based on models of violence and capacities to be violent and to run effective armies. It affects political culture profoundly. And the obvious example is your military dictatorship, whether we're talking about the Nazis in mid-20th century Europe or Africa's more recent dictatorships. So ending this is critical if we're going to be serious about women's rights globally. At every level of social organization, political organization, all the way down into people's sexual and personal identities. I could also make a whole discussion about the sexual implications, the sexual politics of militarism. It's only the most obvious to point to the horrendous mass epidemics of rape in some of our contemporary war zones. That's the, if you like, the extreme edge of a much broader distortion of gender relations, of capacities for being affectionate across the genders, of capacities for love. So really, in a word, militarism is the absolute antithesis of feminism. It's not to say that women are inherently peacemakers, but because of their historically constituted roles, women often do not feel or identify with the sharp ethnic divisions that are used to mobilize men. Women are somehow constituted differently because of the roles that they play. And that's an historical fact, not a biological fact.
What lessons can women's movement and broader movements in the US and globally learn from the organizing that's happening at the ground level?
Probably, yes. We can play an educative role here. I mean, I'm teaching a course now on feminism and militarism, so I would draw examples from the South to educate and inform students here in the US about a reality they really are not well informed about, which is that women do resist and are not just passive victims. Because there's a sort of a savior assumption here in the United States. People feel that everything is okay and women are already equal. And yet they seem to be remaining relatively under-mobilized with regard to the U.S.'s own military enterprise. So I think it's quite a humbling thing to stand and sit here and understand that women in far less privileged and far more far less secure environments are actually mobilizing and organizing themselves to resist militarization, including the United States High Command for Africa. It's very much on the agenda of women's movements in Africa, but I don't hear a huge amount from women's movements here. Women here can learn an enormous amount from what women elsewhere are doing. But most of all, I think it's important that as women in the United States, we don't only look across the seas to see what women are doing, but we form an analysis of the global militarism that is entirely dominated by this location. The United States is responsible for more than half, almost half of the world's military expenditure, and is waging several major wars at the moment. Then actually looking out in other countries should actually force us to turn attention back home and say, well, where are all these armaments coming from? These guns and bombs are not made in Africa. Nobody manufactures, except maybe South Africa, but nobody manufactures these weapons in many of the places where they're being used. So there are big questions that, if you like, threading the insight in back home, I think that's the way in which looking across the borders can be most productive. Because sitting here, women here, there's a limit to how much you can do to help women in other places. And I think that given the... if you like, the demography of militarism, where it's coming from, where the weapons are coming from, where the biggest expenditure is, where the hugest and most powerful army in the world is, then perhaps we should look here. And I do see women in local communities looking at the racial and gendered composition of the U.S. military and the way in which recruitment targets minority communities and the growing number of women in the military. So these are questions here. The nature of military bases, what those do to the surrounding communities in terms of the economy, the gender relations, the environmental toxicity. So I'd like to see and know more about what's happening here.
This is Women's Magazine on KPFA 94.1 FM and online at kpfa.org. You're listening to an interview with Amina Mama, chair of the Women and Gender Studies program at UC Davis.
So that brings me to our focus on AFRICOM, and I want to read a small line from your own introductory article to the journal Feminist Africa that you edit. It says, as of 2007, the escalating militarization is costing a staggering $1,339 billion worldwide, nearly $4 billion US dollars per day, with the US being the biggest spender, accounting for nearly half of that amount. African countries are spending nearly $17 billion a year, of which $10 billion are spent in sub-Saharan Africa. Staggering statistics, Amina. And in that context, can you tell our listeners about AFRICOM, what it is, what the fears and threats that it portends?
Yeah, the AFRICOM refers to the U.S. African High, the U.S. High Military High Command for Africa. And this really came into the public sphere during the Bush administration. So I would say it tracks back to then, and it signifies an escalation of the US's security interests in Africa. Talking about AFRICOM, of course, raises the whole question of security. Whose security? In a region that has had so much military rule and so much conflict and such a legacy of militarism all the way back to the colonial conquest and the militarized states that were created under the colonial occupation, all the way through our history, militarism has been a pervasive theme that has not been a constructive one. As I said, I would say it is almost the antithesis to the pursuit of vibrant civil societies and democratic governance. So it's been a problem for us. So people on the ground in Africa are horrified to think that the future may hold further militarization. Even local militarized governments are unhappy at the idea of foreign military presence. So it's initially provoked a large amount of dissent, even amongst the militarized governments, until they were then called in to partner with it. But initially, they weren't consulted. And I think the United States government went hunting around Africa to find out who would host it, and nobody would. Only one country was willing to host it at that time, Liberia. And it was to do with local security, insecurity, local concerns. The meaning of security in Africa, as expressed in the documentation about AFRICOM, was actually not about security for Africa's people. It's about securing access to Africa's natural assets and resources. So it's an economically motivated project on the one hand. After 9/11, with the whole escalation of the global war on terror, in a sense, that became the pretext for expanding the whole idea and investment in the AFRICOM project. So it got ramped up and became also about Africa's already destroyed states posing a threat to U.S. security. Again, I say, who is more threatened by the collapse of the Somali state? The Somali people or the citizens of the United States? Yet the collapse of states was seen as a threat to the citizens of the United States. There are a lot of ironies in this. But overall, I think that the majority of African, certainly African civil society, has been very vociferous on objecting to this new plan to militarize Africa. So AFRICOM's responses have been interesting as well, because on the one hand, what was initially motivated as a security, a concern with security, as a concern with securing access to resources, the discourse has shifted. It's now become something that is going to be done much more in partnership with African military forces, although many of us feel they're already over-empowered. But it's also, the discourse has shifted so that instead of it just being about armies and training up local armies, it's also couched in humanitarian terms. So you hear about AFRICOM troops digging wells, helping with HIV/AIDS, building schools. And that discursive shift is probably a result of the objections to a military, heavy military presence on the continent. So it raises a question, and I'd ask people to think about this, you know, is there such a thing as a humanitarian militarism? Is the military the right institution to pursue humanitarian agendas and development? It seems to me that there are a great many agencies already available to do that kind of work. So the military are singularly ill-equipped to do humanitarian, except in very extreme situations, humanitarian work. So it's an ongoing debate in relation to AFRICOM, but it does seem that it's proceeding, albeit couched in more sensitive rhetoric with an emphasis on its humanitarian benefits rather than on its security benefits. But it's a military expansion. It's a military project at its roots. So it's hard for me to be persuaded that it's now a humanitarian enterprise.
Blame on our colonial fathers. You say they came and they took all we have possessed. They have to take the abuse and they, of course, the present state within children's history. Use our goodness and nourishment in the name of missionary. To learn from pain. Now it's up to us to gain some recognition. If we stop blaming, we could get a better condition. Wake up, world. Wake up, world.
As a follow-up to what you shared about AFRICOM and its the real purpose being to control Africa's natural resources, could you speak to the connections between militarism and militarized violence and the alarming trends of increased or aggravated industrialized agriculture that is facing many countries in the region? Companies like Monsanto and others that are coming in, and the shift that's happening, that's further, again, like you pointed out, is enabled by Western aid.
I mean, the link between militarism and economics, neoliberalism, is probably drawn or most sharply visible in places like the Niger Delta, because there you have private corporations, Chevron, Texaco, Shell, going about oil exploitation and yet doing it in a way that has so alienated the local communities that increasingly vocal dissent has given rise to a deepening militarization of the whole region. So first, the oil companies have at times called in the national army. There's occasions in which they've actually contracted battalions of the Nigerian army to do what in the colonial days were called pacification work, to pacify local communities who are expressing outrage at dispossession, environmental destruction, loss of livelihoods, non-employment in any of these huge plants, no jobs, high male unemployment, lack of electricity, lack of running water, while billions of dollars of worth of oil are being pumped out. So the contradiction is extreme enough to have provoked people to mobilize. When those local protests and mobilizations, some of them led by women, have been violently suppressed, what's happened is that those communities have had to militarize themselves or have begun to militarize. So you have all these community-based militias and movements arising. So you have, first of all, the corporation, whether it's privatized security agents working for them. You have the involvement of the national military forces as, if you like, aiding and protecting corporate interests in a militarized state that relies on these same corporations for a large chunk of its budget, 80 to 90%, I believe. So you have a complicity between the international corporations and the nation state, which is anti-people. And then you have, of course, the communities militarizing, you could say, in self-defense, because they've not been able to gain from the wealth that's been pumped out of the ground. And that resistance being met with more violence. So over a period of time, the entire community becomes militarized. And that is a link up between corporate capitalism, the nation state, that is, a way to go on its path to democracy. And in a way that has been almost wholly destructive for people living in that region. So there you have a link up. I mean, that kind of link up and its impact on women's lives is profound. These are communities that relied on fishing and harvesting and farming locally and where the environment has been totally destroyed. The sources of livelihood left to women are of the worst kind. The men are without livelihoods. So you have a community that's increasingly rendered backwards and underdeveloped and impoverished. So if developing the national resources culminates in that kind of outcome for local populations, that's not development at all. And it increasingly has to rely on military might to force its own agenda onto communities that actually do want to develop and do want to be democratized and do want to be able to lead productive lives. So there's a case in point. But I think you can take examples of that kind of link up in many of the the resource-rich parts of Africa, the DRC you mentioned earlier. It's interesting, in Africa we speak of a resource curse. Those countries most endowed with huge natural resources, with the potential for enormous wealth, appear to be those that are most subject to militarization through a variety of actors, from corporate actors with their own security forces to other forms of militarization.
So, Amina, how do you see the role or scope of a Pan-African women's movement in linking with other movements in the region and also strengthening women's voices across borders and also across ethnicities and other differences?
There's a long history of Pan-African mobilizing, going back through, to the days of the national liberation struggle. And during the colonial times, interesting links and connections were made between women in different parts of the African region who often met actually overseas and then went home and kept in contact with one another. And there's definitely an upsurge in continental feminism that brings women from the very disparate and diverse parts of Africa together. And the probably the best known expression of that currently is the African Feminist Forum. Not unlike the Latin American Encuentros, we've now had one, two, three. I think the third one is being organized in Dakar. The third continental gathering of feminists. And what's exciting about it is that it's explicitly feminist. I mean, the T-shirts for the forum are "I am no ifs or buts feminist." So a much more, a new level of assertiveness around the politics of feminism and the involvement of several generations of women. The age range in the feminist movement in Africa goes all the way up from relatively young girls and teenagers to women, you know, who've been at it for 3, 4, even 5 decades. So I think we have several generations of women who've articulated gender politics in different ways over the eras, and the concerted effort to bring those into one space for discussion and debate. As I said, there's the African Feminist Forum. There's been a lot of networking among the gender and women's studies people across Africa in the last few years, talking about developing continental thinking around feminist studies, and in a sense rehabilitating, bringing the politics back into what became somewhat diluted as gender activism and gender mainstreaming and all these sort of aid industry related euphemisms. It's not to say that those things have not been important, but they've not been many of them have not been cutting edge in the way that there's this new sharpness in contemporary feminist discourse in Africa. And when I say sharpness, I mean a preparedness to engage with issues that used to be taboo, for example. So you have an open debate on sexuality and lesbianism and sex work at the feminist forum. And that, you know, a few years ago, an awful lot of women who would say they were women activists or gender activists would have run away when you tabled those issues and tried to distance themselves from it for fear of being further marginalized. But I think nowadays we all know that once you talk about, whether you talk about women or gender or feminist, you're going to incur the same level of resistance and male reaction, regardless. They'll call you a feminist. So it's like taking back the terrain and saying, yes, we're feminists and we're opposed to the oppression of women and we're against militarism and we're going to defend women's rights to define their own sexuality and sexual preferences. We're going to defend women's rights to challenge female genital mutilation just as much as we're going to defend women's rights to free and proper healthcare. So a much broader, more assertive feminism. And I think within that, there's a great and exciting potential that that we can all contribute to, both within the continent and indeed beyond. A lot of Africa's feminists are very diasporized. We travel all over the place. Many of us met each other away from home. So bringing all that together under the broad rubric of feminism in Africa infuses it with a cosmopolitanism and a transnational understanding of how global politics is iterated all the way across Africa in different incarnations. I mean, the need to compare those experiences, as I said, those different iterations of global capitalism and neoliberalism in different African communities, and bring those together so that you can have a more visionary and more concerted response. I think that's very much what's happening. It's the most exciting thing that's happening today.
In the context of the increasing militarization that you spoke about through AFRICOM, what gives you hope in the context of increasing militarization, and even more recently in the context of the disaster aid, as we have seen more recently in Haiti and Pakistan, where the military and private contractors and corporations are once more trying to take over the life of civilians at a time, especially when they're most vulnerable?
Yes, it's a machine that finds many ways of justifying its existence and extending its influence. You know, whether it's a political collapse, that's a pretext for going in and defending against perceived possible threats, or, you know, a natural disaster that raises an already fragile economy to the ground and flattens it so that there's nothing to withstand the corporate players that then rush in, securing contracts and pursuing their for-profit agendas. It's bleak. I think it's very grim to think that a natural disaster or a political collapse both invoke create an opportunity for militarism once the world is set up that way. I think the thing that gives me hope, if you looked at watch the coverage on Haiti, is that people are more aware of this. So you're hearing the counter discourse at the same time. You're hearing the protests about all the money, about foreign contractors monopolizing the rebuilding, and how important it is to take that destruction as an opportunity for growing back local capacity, indeed taking it to new levels, and the importance of involving local movements and local civil societies and creating local employment and local economic gain rather than just allowing transnationals to come in and make profit out of a disaster. It's interesting. I listened to a Haitian talking about this. It reminded me of nothing so much as Sakina Yacoubi's discussions around Afghanistan, where she's saying there's all these contractors with their massive expense on their own security and huge costs doing jobs that local communities could do for 0.001% of the cost. If it's digging a well, it costs so many tens of thousands of dollars for one of the listed and approved contractors to do it. So this contracting process is quintessentially capitalist. It has layers and layers of profit making that means that the cost is great and the delivery is small in terms of what's actually, what are the end products, how much rebuilding is do you get for your for the amount that it costs. And not just rebuilding, but building up people's skills, building up the human resource base of the country, building up the capacities to sustain itself in future. These are the things that get left out when you bus in or allow international contractors to take over piecework, humanitarian relief or rebuilding infrastructure. Can there be a humanitarian militarism? The main thing that gives hope is that all of us have within our reach the means to join the dots, to make these links, the access we have to information, to forming transnational connections with women very far away from where we are, for exchanging that information and informing each other's resistance strategies is greater than it's ever been. So on the one hand, the scenario looks bleak and more intimidating than it's ever been. But on the other hand, the vociferousness of the resistance and the sophistication of the responses of even the most rural and marginalized communities. They're responding in ways that are sophisticated and that we can, that even the most highly educated person in the West can learn a lot from. So that flow of information and spread of resistance strategies creates enormous potential. And the thing that gives me the most hope is that you see people resisting. You see people saying, we want to own our own future. We want to be the architects of our destiny. We want our people to be employed in our rebuilding, not just have it outsourced to foreign interests. So I think there's a great deal of cause for optimism, particularly when I spend so much of my time with younger women. They're just not going to put up with the things that women put up with before. So that I think is a continuous source of inspiration.
Thank you, Amina. I'm Preeti Mangalashekar, and I've been in discussion with Amina Mama, who is the director of the Women and Gender Studies Program at the University of California, Davis, and a board member of the Global Fund for Women.
For more feminist analysis about postcolonial continental African feminism, visit feministafrica.org. And for local events focusing on Africa and the African diaspora here in the Bay Area, visit PriorityAfricaNetwork.org.